The musician, actor, and artist David Bowie died on January 10th of this year, just days after the release of his final album, Black Star. Bowie was one of the most iconic figures in music of the last 50 years, whose explorations and tastes were constantly evolving. Bowie's musical experimentation led him to adopt numerous stage persona, among the most iconic being the androgynous alien Ziggy Stardust. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. Today we remember not only David Bowie, but also the film testament of his early 1970s, the documentary concert film Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. In 1973, the renowned filmmaker D.A. Pennebaker and a small crew captured Bowie's final concert in the guise of Ziggy Stardust, immortalizing a moment in rock and roll history on film. Today we remember David Bowie and his final performance as Ziggy Stardust with a re-airing of my conversation from the summer of 2013 with filmmaker D.A. Pennebaker. I should note you're joining us by phone from your office in New York. The film and the concert are celebrating an anniversary this year. You, by this point in 1973, were already acclaimed for a number of films with musicians in them, Bob Dylan's Don't Look Back, Monterey Pop, some others.
Yeah.
How did you first get involved with David Bowie in the making of this concert film?
Well, it was a little complicated. I was on a raft, which I built with some friends of mine, a theater group, on the Mississippi River. We were going from St. Louis to New Orleans. We stopped from time to time, and I would get messages. And one of them was that RCA wanted me to go to London to record. The guy that had the jazzy music. Anyway, I didn't know who it was. I didn't know Bowie yet. I'd maybe heard the song about the guy on the Space Invader or whatever he was.
Right, Space Oddity.
Yeah, but I didn't really identify David at all. I didn't know him. Anyway, I said, well, I can't. I'm on a raft. And then I got, about a week later, I got another, somebody else came from RCA and said, listen, we need to have you because Bowie wants you to do it. And what it was not to do a concert. So what they needed was they had built or designed or invented a new kind of video machine, video player, and they wanted something to promote it. Hmm. And I think that they actually had, Bowie was under contract to them, so it looked like a fairly inexpensive way to do it. And they wanted a little half-hour film. So at this point, somebody I knew from RCA got hold of me, and I agreed to go. So I left the raft and flew to London, which at that point was a little complicated because I think there was a strike in the airline. So we had to go to Rome and from Rome to London. And we got there. The concert was going to be on Sunday, and we got there Saturday morning. So we saw one performance Saturday night. His manager may have said this is going to be the last concert, but you know, it didn't mean anything to me. So we set up to shoot one Sunday night concert. And when I had seen him in performing on the Saturday night, I realized that this was a kind of an extraordinary performance. And only three of us had gone, Jim Desmond and Nick Dube and I, the three of us. And Nick actually had never shot with us before. He was up at Yale, I think, at the time. But I didn't think it would take much to do a 20-minute piece. And when I saw this, we sat down and said, you know, this is really a movie. We have to film it. And the three of us are going to have to do it. So we went into the hall that night, and we put signs up saying, be sure and bring your cameras with flashbulbs and shoot all the flashbulb shots you can shoot during the performance, which the management thought was very bizarre. And the next day, we set up and actually filmed Bowie that day and that concert, and that was it. And then in the middle of it somewhere, he said to the audience, this is going to be the last one we'll ever do. And I remember Mick Ronson saying, what? Yelling behind me. So I realized he hadn't even told his whole orchestra. But it was such an amazing concert that, I mean, it was amazing in many ways for me. I had never quite seen anything like it because that entire audience, which was had lots of people in it. I think Marlene Dietrich was there and all sorts of interesting people. But that whole audience did backup for him on some songs. So he had this incredible sound coming out of the theater itself, sort of behind the music he was doing, and it was such an extraordinary sound. And luckily, the guys from RCA had brought up the new Studer, which I think was 24-track. So we had really pretty good sound for the whole thing.
It's really extraordinary watching this film and hearing your story just now, thinking that you were on the Mississippi River, and then a few days later, with 24 hours notice, you make this feature-length film. For those who don't know who Ziggy Stardust was, this was David Bowie's sort of alter ego for a few years there, where he would perform as kind of an androgynous alien. So it's part of the glam rock period in rock and roll history. But as you say, it was not known to many of the members of his own band that this would be the final time that that character would perform, nor the audience. Did you know before that last concert?
Well, somebody may have told me, but I just passed it off as PR of some sort. I didn't understand what that meant. But, you know, later when I made the film, and I had to make the film pretty much by myself because RCA wasn't interested at all in it. We had built a little studio to be able to mix the sound because RCA had this huge mixing setup. But I went over there with David, and he didn't like it. It was terrible for him. So we decided to do our own mixing. I got two Haitians up at Columbia to come in who had some electronic background, and we built a little, not so little, but a big enough one to actually mix four tracks. And we made a four-track stereo mix. And then we actually had a dubber recording, the 35 that we used to play back 35 tracks. And we actually made, because that was how you made it in those days, the print, the 35 print, had two tracks on each side so that there were, in effect, four soundtracks on the print as it went through the projector. And the projector had a big reader at the top of the projector that could read the four tracks. And so we actually recorded our four track onto a print, and we took the print to England up at up in the north there. They have a big thing every year in Scotland where they show theater and films. It's kind of a big deal. It's in the summer. And so we took the print and we ran the print. And the thing that was amazing was the audience at that screening must have been almost the same audience as was in Hammersmith because we had set it up. We had done some experimental things of when we had four tracks, you could take a four track and put on the surround just a background, but you could also intercut them so that you could put a sound anywhere in the theater. That is, it would look as if it were coming from midway back of the theater side. You could do, it was rough, but you could kind of do that. So we had done that with some of the people yelling out. And in the showing, actually, the person who was yelling out was there yelling out, really. So we had him recorded. We also had him really in the theater, and he's been there at Hammersmith and sitting in the same place. So it was kind of a funny showing. But so, Bowie wasn't there, but he heard about it, and so he called and said, was I really serious about releasing the film? And I said, yes, I was. And so he said, well, I'll come and help you do it. So he showed up, and we spent the next 3 or 4 weeks mixing the tracks and making the film as it is now, which David really helped doing a lot.
What was your idea of putting up the signs around the concert hall the day before of flash photography?
Well, the thing is, the sound from that in that theater, especially on Watch That Man and some of the films, where the audience all sang, but they didn't sing along with them. They sang backup. And I wanted it to really be a frenzy. And when those flash bulbs went off, they were terrific. Because it was dark, except the front two or three rows. But when the flash bulbs would go off, we'd see whole areas of the theater and sometimes people totally clearly in the concert. So it was kind of it made the concert kind of, like a mission of some sort. It was much bigger than just a normal music concert, I thought.
Yeah, you wanted to convey the community that was built around the music.
Yeah, they were all so with it, I mean, he had brought with him into that theater not just kids. I mean, the kids, of course, were in the front rows yelling and screaming, but he had brought all sorts of people that were fascinated by this music, as was I, you know. And so it was an extraordinary moment to be able to film it.
For people who have not seen in a while concert footage from the 60s and 70s, when I presume you're shooting on 16 millimeter, because of the spotlights and the dark theaters, it tends to just be the performers that are lit up. And particularly in this film, how David Bowie just seems to float in a sea of black sometimes.
You don't even see the band. It's just him and this incredible audience that he's falling into. I mean, it's like a big sea of people and voices. I really kind of like that effect. And I figured, you know, when we shot it, that's what we concentrated, just on him. The three of us. I was behind him most of the time, and Nick and Jim were right in front, so that we didn't try to film anybody else very much.
What's fascinating to me is your early story about how you found out about the concert and were asked to do it and didn't really know the music of David Bowie, except for maybe one song. That, you know, by the 60s and 70s, you were quite a bit older than most of the concert-going fans that you were capturing. And do you remember what it was about the music and these groups or these performers that were attracting you at that stage in your life to these concerts and making these films?
When I heard the music, it was new music. I mean, I had listened to a lot of the stuff, you know, after Monterey. I got to know quite a few of those bands, and I would hear them and have records, and I knew Janis, and I knew Jimmy, and I knew all those people, and I knew their music. And suddenly here was a whole new kind of music that I had, well, I just hadn't ever heard before.
And when you say Janis, you mean Janis Joplin, and Jimmy is Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
So that should put things in perspective. You captured the famous, iconic image of Jimi Hendrix lighting his guitar on fire at Monterey Pop.
Yeah, I think that was almost, he had been playing in the Village down at the Cafe Y, I guess, but I didn't know anything about him. And John Phillips told me, they said, this guy's a great blues player, and he sets his guitar on fire. And I thought, that's interesting. I'd never heard of a blues guitar player doing that, because guitars were fairly valuable in the South where the blues players began. And so when he did it, you know, we were only going to film one song, but we filmed everything that Jimmy did, because it was such an amazing set, as was Otis, as was The Who. You know, a lot of those sets were incredible.
Seems like a pattern there. As a documentary filmmaker, I guess you have to be in the moment and know when something's happening that needs to be put on film.
You kind of go by your feelings. I mean, that was such a huge concert, and there were so many people there, and we only had a certain amount of film, although we had to go get more film because we used it all up. But the idea of shooting a whole concert was impossible. It would just take too long. And then I did another one in Toronto. There was a huge concert, but it had four guys. It had the four big rock stars of the time, Little Richard. And
was it Bo Diddley at that
time? Yeah, Bo Diddley. Anyway, but there were a lot of other acts that were terrific that I liked, but we decided just to concentrate on four. And then with David, it was kind of wonderful because I could just have one. And that made it such a singular event for me. It was like I'd seen a black hole and gone into it. You know, it was an incredible kind of musical performance to bathe in, as it were, with a camera.
When you were making these concert films, were you you don't direct in the sense of narrative film, because you're not quite sure what's going to happen next, but are you seeking to try to be invisible as just an observer, or does the camera change?
Well, I don't think you can be invisible, and I think it's foolish to try to be invisible. He's singing to several thousand people. You know, what would being invisible do? But I think you learn to watch, and to watch very intently, and you have in your hands this incredible machine that can't lie. So what you watch, you can later put out before people, and they can see what it is you are watching. That, to me, is miraculous that you can do that.
You know, this strikes me that this year also marks the 60th anniversary of your first short film, Daybreak Express, and the start of your career. I'm
I'm wondering over those 60 years if moving pictures, you know, now that surround us around the world, everyone's shooting something that's quasi-reality-based. Has the role or challenge of being a documentary filmmaker changed in the last six decades, you think?
Well, it's got a little more crowded. but, you know, in a way, I always thought this was going to happen. It just took a while. I mean, when I began, nobody else was doing it, and with good reason, because nobody wanted it. Television was totally not interested, and you couldn't go into a theater with it. That's why when I got Daybreak into a theater, even though it was 5 minutes long, I thought I'd made a conquest. I thought I'd figured out how to beat the system. But, of course, that didn't happen when I did the Don't Look Back and later Monterey. It was very hard to get it into theaters, and we couldn't get a distributor. We had to distribute ourselves. My sense was you had to go into theaters because it was like if you were writing operas, you had to play in an opera house. They couldn't play out in the street or in a park because that's the only place people would take them seriously and that you would get some kind of critical feedback. And that's what you must have if you're going to have a film, because it's never going to play anywhere else unless somebody says, go see this film. And you needed to have that by getting into a theater where the arrangement was the theater and the newspaper that had the critic had a deal and they all kind of played for each other. So you could get sneak in on that deal and get a respectable sort of witnessing of what you had. I mean, sometimes it depended. Like the Cleveland Plain dealer said that the person who made Don't Look Back should have his mouth washed out with soap, which turned out to be, for us, a fantastic ad.
Then everybody wanted to see what.
Everybody wanted to see what that was about. So, but you know, you were taken seriously by an area that you needed. Otherwise, you made a documentary and it sat in your home in your closet. It never came out because nobody knew about it.
Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars turns 40 this year. Did you ever imagine that 40 years on, David Bowie would still be going strong?
Yeah. I could just see that what he was doing was so incredible and so singular. I mean, nobody else was doing anything like that I knew of. Now, there probably were people. Bowen was doing something like this. He was, I guess that's who I thought David was, actually. Not that I saw, certainly not in the going on in the U.S. So, and you know, when I made the film, there's no way I could really market the film. I didn't have the rights to any of the music or anything. And ABC heard about it and came and said they wanted to run it on the air. And I said, okay. Because I had no rights at all, but I said, let them, you know, I felt safe because we were broke. We have no money, so nobody was going to sue us for anything. So I could almost get away with murder, as it turned out. But when we put the film out, they came and they said, you know, we're going to have to beep this film because he's talking about suicide and using a lot of bad language, and we can't put that on the air. And so I called David. David was somewhere out in the West. I don't know what he was smoking, but he was in wild state. And he said, just make sure the beeps are good and loud. So we beeped the track for ABC. But what ABC didn't seem to know, which is interesting to me because they were a network, you know, those people all they were at the top of the pile, in a sense. And there was an arrangement that FM had arranged. I don't know who done it, but you could give a track to an FM station, and they would run it in sync with the film. I don't know how they arranged to do this. And so we gave them one with no beeps. So the entire country saw the film with no beeps.
Listening to
except
their
the
FM
people
radio.
Who were tuned into ABC, they, of course, got the beeps. But it was terrific, and I got all this feedback from it. People said, my God, this is what they're doing. I've never seen anything like this on radio, television before. So it was. I could see that it was David was something to be dealt with, you know, as far as American TV was concerned. And David kind of dug it, too, I think, so that when we went to London and showed the print, that just the fact that we could put this in a theater and show it as a regular movie kind of intrigued him.
Well, I'm certainly glad you were there to capture it and persevered through getting it out into the world. It's been a true honor to getting to speak with you today, Mr. Pennebaker.
You know, I just saw the film the other day. I was up at the place where Eastman Kodak once was.
Oh, the Eastman House?
Yeah.
George Eastman.
They're still sort of there, but in a much reduced state. It was one of the films that I showed up there. I just was invited to come up and show some films. And I hadn't seen it in a long time. They had a beautiful projection system, and I think, I don't know what we showed. We didn't show an actual 35 print. I think we showed some sort of video that EMI had struck off, because that was one of the things that was great. EMI then distributed, so we got a distributor finally to show it around the world, in effect. But when I saw the film, just looking at it, David was just like a red-hot ingot that you put into a can of cold water, you know. He just exploded on that screen. And everybody, after each song, people in the theater would all clap like it was a concert, because it was no narration and no interviews with anybody, just this incredible performance that people saw, you know, right on screen. It was almost as beautiful as the original was for me. So it was incredible. So when I came back, I sent an email to David and told him what a terrific showing it had. He was very excited.
That's great. You still stay up with him. I'm so glad you got to see it recently, and lots of listeners can see it. It's still on video. You've released it and is very available. So thank you again for speaking with us today.
Okay.
You've been listening to my conversation with documentary filmmaker D.A. Pennebaker, recorded in 2013 on the eve of the 40th anniversary of David Bowie's historic final concert in the guise of Ziggy Stardust. The resultant film, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, would be a lasting testament to the times and talent of one of the world's most original artists. David Bowie, musician, actor, and artist, died on January 10th, 2 days after his 69th birthday and the release of his final album, Black Star, a carefully crafted final exit on Bowie's road of experimentation. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.